Public radio is here for you. It doesn't matter how old you are, how big your home is, or what kind of car you drive. WOSU and NPR connect you to news and information in civil conversations. That's why 43 million Americans listen to NPR each week. WOSU is part of our community, covering and discussing issues important to you, standing with the facts. Meet the moment with WOSU. Go to WOSU.org/protect.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. For decades, American research institutions have been the gold standard for human innovation. The federal government has been backing labs since World War II. But with recent $2.7 billion in funding cuts to the National Institute of Health and the National Science Foundation, researchers and scientists have been left in a precarious position. Brain drain is when groups of highly educated individuals leave a country. And with these funding cuts and threats to universities across the country, could we see this brain drain? Joining us now is Glenn Altshuler, Emeritus Professor of American Studies at Cornell University. He has written extensively about American history, politics, and higher education. Welcome to All Sides, Professor Altshuler.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you.
So there's been a few articles published recently, one in the science journal Nature. There's a couple in Foreign Affairs and in some newspapers across the country. And they all ask the question, with the loss of research money at universities across the country, is America heading toward a brain drain? So could you give us a brief rundown on what you think brain drain means in these circumstances right now?
Well, what brain drain means is a loss of distinguished faculty members who are actively engaging in research, who decide for a number of reasons to leave their positions, perhaps to take positions abroad.
Do you think, that the premise of some of these articles I've read, you know, I mentioned Foreign Affairs and Nature talking about it. Do you think that the United States is going to start falling into a brain drain? Do you think there's enough funding cuts that we're seeing people considering leaving?
Well, there are very disturbing signs already of that, Amy, especially because the funding cuts, clawbacks have been so immediate that they have interrupted current research of faculty members in the sciences, computer science, engineering, and those faculty members are seeking ways in which their research is not interrupted. So it's both an immediate problem and a long-term problem. And I will tell you, I had a conversation recently with a very distinguished faculty member who is a MacArthur Genius fellow, and he told me that he has written more letters of recommendation for colleagues seeking positions abroad in the last couple of months than he has in the last 20 or 30 years.
Yeah, I mean, that's anecdotal, but definitely very telling. Do you have any personal experience with funding being pulled from a program that you're associated with or anything that you're involved with Cornell?
Well, in American studies, alas, we don't get a lot of federal funding. So I don't have a personal experience because for a long time I was a dean and vice president. I have many friends on the Cornell faculty and elsewhere who are dependent on grants and who are extraordinarily attuned to reductions or planned reductions. There are also concerns, quite frankly, that other measures by the government, taxes on the endowments of wealthy universities, also, and very importantly, in the decrease in indirect cost recovery has profound implications for what university researchers do, how they do it, and whether their host universities can continue to be sponsoring them.
Now, for the most part, what the Trump administration is saying is that some of these grants and this money, this funding, has just gotten out of control. There's too much of it. There, you know, and I mean, it is regulating what types of research are getting funded. But overall, I think the premise is that there's too much of it. But what do you see like that connection between research at universities and how it helps the country as a whole? Because that's how it was seen in World War II. You know, the federal government saw that it would help them get ahead. Is that still the case today?
Well, I think you have to judge research by the impact of that research, whether it's in medicine or it's in computing and information sciences, whether it supports the defense industry. And in most instances, the evidence shows dramatically how much research funding contributes to the GDP. And in fact, a recent study in Scientific American indicated that a 50% reduction in science funding would result in a 7.6% reduction in the gross, the GDP of the United States. 7.6 reduction in the GDP is a catastrophe for the economy. So nobody's saying there's going to be a 50% reduction in science funding by the government, but that'll give you a sense of the magnitude of the positive contribution that scientific research makes in this country. And let me say as well that who recognizes that? The Chinese recognize that. They're putting much more money into research, as we are putting much less money into research. And you don't have to be a genius, and you can even be a professor of American studies, a non-quantitative guy, to understand what that will mean for the global leadership of the United States.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about America's potential brain drain, with scientists and researchers looking for more secure funding while federal grants remain up in the air. And we're talking with Glenn Altschuler, Emeritus Professor of American Studies at Cornell University. One of the stipulations of university funding is agreeing with the Trump administration when it comes to things like immigration policies, diversity, equity, and inclusion practices. And recently, Columbia University recently made some changes requested by the Trump administration in hopes of getting their federal funding restored. If other schools follow Columbia's path, could that alleviate some of this pressure, maybe keep scientists here?
Well, the profound difference between the nature of the penalties imposed and the alleged misbehavior by universities is extraordinarily striking. So I'll put it in gross terms. You have some expressions or actions that are anti-Semitic, and so you punish professors who have no connection to those activities. And so punishment and discipline needs to be proportionate to and relevant to the perceived behavior by the universities. So to be honest, it's a little crazy to me, to look at that equivalence being made, and the nature of the penalties, billions of dollars in research funding, especially when universities have said, if we've not done enough to combat anti-Semitism. We're committed to doing more. And if you take a look at the response of universities, there's evidence that they are doing more. And so, according to the Title VI guidelines themselves, there needs to be a discussion about appropriate remedies before those remedies are in fact enacted by the government. And the government itself has not observed the Title VI guidelines for how you move forward when you have a concern about infractions. So there are many issues involving whether or not universities should acquiesce, as Columbia did. I'll say this: acquiescing isn't helping Columbia very much, and I think other universities are seeing that. And so how universities respond is what we in the trade call a no-win situation for them, at least at the moment. That's how it looks from this angle.
What are the Title VI guidelines? You mentioned that twice. Is that regulations on research, Title VI
It's
guidelines?
regulations about civil rights complaints. How do you adjudicate civil rights complaints? And the anti-Semitism issue, from the point of view of the Trump administration, Department of Education, and other agencies, is a civil rights issue, and therefore it is alleged to be a violation of Title VI. There are instructions for how you deal with a Title VI complaints, and they certainly don't say that the penalties need to be immediately applied before all of those procedures have been observed.
Okay, and you mentioned earlier that China is our biggest competitor here. They're going to ramp up their research because they're watching what's happening here. But there's also other countries trying to court people from America, Canada, Europe, Australia. I mentioned earlier that even France has a Choose France for Science campaign going on. Do you
Saudi
see?
Arabia? Saudi Arabia?
So where do you see most people moving to? I would think that pulling an American and moving them to China is probably more complicated than moving to France, I would guess.
Well, remember, there are many, many researchers who are Chinese operating in the United States. There have been, over time, many Chinese postdocs. And others. So where you move has a lot to do with your current circumstances, your life circumstances, your past, your views, and all the rest. But the example you gave of open advertising for faculty members exists. And remember, we live in a global age, and very active researchers often collaborate with people in other countries. And those researchers will probably be more amenable if they get offers from the countries to which their collaborators already reside, as one possibility. It also, your familial situation, your political views, and so on are relevant. I think it's important to say that for decades and decades and decades, the United States was the place to come to. It attracted more foreigners. That be reversed has profound implications for the future, and other countries realize that. They realize that research is the name of the game if you want to advance economically. And that's why, Emmy, if I may say so, this is one of the biggest self-inflicted wounds I've ever witnessed in my 112 years as a faculty member. This is injuring your own country for aims and goals that are not entirely clear to me, that there ought to be a huge gain if, in fact, you are kneecapping one of the most successful enterprises in American history. And you refer to the National Science Foundation when it was founded at the end of World War II and made this partnership with universities. Vannevar Bush, head of the NSF, did it. It was one of the best ideas of the 20th century, and it has reaped dividends year after year after year after year.
Well, I want to say thank you. Thank you, Glenn Altshuler, Emeritus Professor of American Studies at Cornell University. Thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
And coming up, we're going to talk about how America's unique system of innovation and research based at universities has helped the U.S. stay ahead of other countries for many years. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money Podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. America has been the beacon of global innovation since World War II. The federal government has been in partnership with America's best and brightest at colleges and universities for decades. This partnership has produced everything from the atomic bomb to the internet to artificial intelligence. A recent survey of 1,600 scientists who responded to a poll in the science journal Nature shows that 75% of them are considering leaving the United States. They cite a variety of reasons, but top among them is unstable funding now that the future of federal grants is unknown. And countries like China, France, and Japan have already started welcoming American researchers with open arms. So are we seeing the first ever American brain drain of our top scientists and researchers? Joining us to talk about this is Sarah Kreps, a professor of government at Cornell University and the director of the Tech Policy Institute. Welcome to the show, Professor Kreps.
Thank you for having me, Amy.
So you wrote a piece that appeared in Foreign Affairs about the relationship between American universities and America's power around the world. Can you expand on that? How important is the work of research universities to the United States' place in this world?
Yeah, so I wrote this piece for a few reasons. And I should say I wrote it the way I did because what I wanted to do was address this question of that brain drain that you're talking about, potential brain drain, and the pauses or kind of reevaluation of federal funding to universities. I was thinking I wanted to put that on the same terms that might be that the administration might find resonant, and that seemed to be if we want to be this. Make America great again, kind of international leader, what's the best way to think about that? And to me, this was really salient because the type of research that is being reevaluated in the sciences and national security in particular is the same kind of research that propelled the U.S. to global leadership in the 40s and has allowed it to sustain that leadership right up until today. So I made the argument going back historically about the importance of federal funding, not just for universities, but for the United States and its role in the world.
Now, we spent the first part of the show talking about brain drain and what might happen if some of the brightest minds leave America because of their funding no longer being here. What's your take on brain drain? Will it happen quickly or will we not really notice it and it'll take a few years?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a little bit more skeptical about a mass exodus of scientists to other countries. And it reminds me a little bit when people have talked over decades about the dollar, the decline of the US dollar. And, you know, it's like, well, there are problems with the US dollar, but it turns out that alternatives are actually worse. And I think that's what people would find in the case of doing science around the world, is that the funding isn't nearly as good, the freedom isn't as good, the living conditions. I mean, and that I think comes back to the basis of my article, which is there is no rival to US higher education. You can't go to Germany and find the same system that you have here. And it's why the US has generated so many Nobel laureates that are foreign born, a little bit like what we saw in the Manhattan Project, where so many of those scientists had left their home countries to come to the United States to do their work. And I think that's still true today. And my guess is if we had to predict 5 to 10 years out, we'll see that this was a blip, an important one, if it's not corrected, but not one that will necessarily have led to an exodus just because of the stability and longevity of U.S. Institutions over centuries.
Now, what do you think about the incentive programs that China and Europe have put in place already? They've done it already. They're quick, trying to recruit mm-hmm. Americans and other foreign scientists who may be working in America, trying to bring them to different countries. Like France, for example, has already implemented their Choose France for Science initiative. Do you think a lot of other countries will follow suit?
I think it's really smart for them to be doing this mm-hmm. because they see this entree. And again, it might be that, you know, American scientists or scientists who are working in America say that, you know, my funding's been cut. Maybe I'll entertain offers elsewhere. I think, though, they'll get there, get to China, realize they can't do the kind of work they want to do, and have the freedom to say what they want to say and realize that the grass wasn't really greener. There might be isolated cases where they can find otherwise. But, you know, I've spent a lot of time abroad and I always come back to the fact that the U.S. has its problems, but fewer problems than other places. And I say that right now as someone who has, for full disclosure, lost a $3 million DOD contract. And mm-hmm. so it hits home pretty closely, this current moment. But I recognize that higher education really has no rival, as I said earlier. So I'm not now suddenly looking to uproot myself and my family and live in Stockholm because or wherever, you know, in Guangzhou in China because of what's happening right now. I think I have a longer view. Yeah. But I should say, Amy, that I have the privilege of being tenured. So it might be different if you're an assistant professor somewhere and you have to get research and articles out and now you lost all your grants and you can't do that.
Yeah, the $3 million that you lost, you said it was a Department of Defense grant. Was that current money that you had already spent? Was it money you were counting on, or was it future money? And so now you have time to plan around it.
No time to plan around it. We had done about 10% of the research, and then we got a stop work order that we could not continue doing the work that we were doing. And I think it's important work. It's on the cybersecurity of the semiconductor supply chain, which sounds like a mouthful, but these are the chips that go into every F-35, every tank, every piece of military hardware. And so that was kind of another reason I wrote this article, which is I thought, I get a sense of where the administration is coming from about kind of the ideologically insular universities, but it's a real kind of shooting yourself in the foot strategy to now undo this important work on national defense as the way to deal with it.
I said in my opening that the science journal Nature did a poll of scientists and they asked if they were planning to leave America. Now, obviously, this is anecdotal and was not a scientific poll. But of the people who responded to Nature, 1,200 scientists responded and said, yes, they're considering leaving the United States because of disruptions caused by the Trump administration. What's your reaction to that?
I think in it's sort of an easy thing to say as a I'm really upset about the current moment, but I do think where the rubber meets the road, it would be interesting to see kind of what opportunities actually manifest for those 75% of scientists, whether they can get anywhere. I mean, because the grants are one thing, but the frankly the pay in U.S. universities is considerably higher than almost anywhere around the world. And so when they start to kind of make this a concrete prospect, I wonder how that will shake out. And I think that will kind of dislodge a little bit of that romanticism of, oh, I can do my work somewhere else and it will be just as good, if not better.
This is all
maybe
sides.
People have to go out and realize that they need to see, you know, what is the apples to apples? Is it apples to apples? And then they can think about it.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about America's potential brain drain with Sarah Krepps, a professor of government at Cornell University and the director of the Tech Policy Institute. Now, you mentioned that China is trying to recruit people to come do research in China. They're meeting this moment. But China can't allow the same academic freedom that we have in the United States. Tell me more about that. Do they, in China, they don't allow you to work independently? Do they really control things?
Yeah, it's something I think we can very easily take for granted being here in the U.S., where the fact is that we do have so many avenues and outlets for exchange and discourse. I have not been to China, I have to say that, but I spent a little bit of time in Singapore, and it was surprising, even over conversations at lunch with colleagues, the kinds of things I could say as someone not employed by that university versus what they were allowed to say about the political leadership in Singapore. And Singapore is, you know, it's a kind of an unusual idiosyncratic case, but I think what those experiences shed light on is just, and they couldn't do the kind of research that they wanted to do because of the political consequences of what they might find in that research. So that was really an eye opener, and I think is emblematic of what you find outside the kind of freedom of a U.S. University setting.
We've seen in recent years, I mean, for a long time, recruiting some of the best minds from China. They come to America to do their research. Do you anticipate that maybe a part of this brain drain could be that some of them might not be allowed to stay? There is that issue of whether visas will be renewed or if you're here just to work, whether you can stay or not.
It's part of the challenge, I think, in these last few months is just the signal to noise ratio. There's so much noise that it can be really hard to infer what the actual signal is. And so some of that conversation about visas and will they be renewed on the U.S. side or the China side, so a lot of that seems to have died down in the last month or so. I mean, think about a few weeks ago, we were talking about 145% tariffs, and now we suddenly have this, you know, great deal on the table about what that might look like. So I think it's hard to say how that will actually shake out. And I think one of the reasons it has served both sides fairly well to be able to have those exchanges. In some ways, it has served the U.S. a lot better than China, because we have tended to be the beneficiary of their scientists who go in search of academic freedom to say what they want to say and research what they want to research.
Another thing that struck me that you wrote in your foreign affairs piece is you wrote that other countries try to replicate what the United States has, with so much research at universities trickling down to help the federal government, the relationship that universities and federal funding has and how it helps, it basically helps the federal government get ahead. Can other countries replicate that, or is it kind of too late?
That's a really good question. And I think it comes back to the kind of privileged perch that we have here in the U.S., where we have this very large country, so many resources. We have the ability to have basically redundancy in our system so that we can get the best results. So we have federal funding, we have industry funding, we have nonprofit funding, foundations, and all of these are, it's like a tapestry of research that gets done, and so you can yield the best results. Other countries don't have that wealth that the U.S. has, and you know, it's hard to say what came first. Their research environments are a lot more centralized, which means, you know, you have big national labs in the UK or in France. And we have a much more decentralized innovation model. And each one of these funding sources, if you think about it, has different incentives. So industry wants shorter term returns on investment so they can focus on, you know, monetizing, commercializing. And historically, the value of federal funding was that they didn't have to think about those short term revenues. They didn't have to, they could think about longer term. We don't know what's going to end up being fruitful. We're going to study all of this fundamental research, and then it turns out to support something like the Manhattan Project or ARPANET that leads to the internet, or guidance systems, orbital mechanics that lead to the GPS systems we have today. Those all started with federal funding, where they weren't looking for commercial gain. And so the value of the U.S. system is that kind of complexity and decentralization that has, I think, yielded the results that lead to that leadership position I was talking about earlier.
Now, do you think that there is private money out there to make up for this in the short term? Is there, you know, you mentioned that you lost $3 million related to studying cybersecurity for chips. You know, there's plenty of private companies that make those. So wouldn't they want someone studying their cybersecurity? So is there private money out there to be found?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think in some ways, and those, as you said it, Amy, that these the industry certainly has a vested interest in this research, and they should feel free to reach out.
You're like, I'll take some money, yes.
If they want to underwrite this work. Right. So I was thinking about it with the Gates Foundation saying that, you know, Bill Gates saying he's going to give away all his money. And so what do those numbers, how do those numbers compare? I just haven't seen any of those big gifts going to universities the way we've seen in the past. I don't know if they're in a wait and see mode or whether they think the politics is too fraught, but it's certainly not replacing the sources of federal funding. And I should also say, as someone who has benefited from foundation funding, it's sort of along the lines of what I was just saying, is that each aspect of funding has its own set of interests and vision. And so if the virtue of the federal funding system is that they put a sort of national level focus at the forefront. Whereas if you're an individual, you have kind of your pet project. You have that thing that you think is important, but that might not be the same thing that the country that is valuable to the country. And so if you've made a lot of money, you might decide that your project is something maybe, and in the Gates Foundation, this is a lot of it, is like the international development, building latrines abroad. That's very different from doing orbital mechanics that is going to kind of help the U.S. in space and in national security.
Staying with us is Sarah Kreps, a professor of government at Cornell University and the director of the Tech Policy Institute. Coming up, we're going to talk about the history of America's research framework. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. In 1940, federal funding for research was about $69 million. By 1944, that had ballooned to $720 million. And that investment only grew during the Cold War. And then came the space race, and eventually the creation of the internet and artificial intelligence. America leading the way in these areas because research was happening at universities, funded at least in part by the federal government. With recent federal funding cuts to the National Institute of Health and the National Science Foundation, researchers and scientists have been left in a precarious position. Stay in the U.S. with less access to money or leave. And Europe is already courting American scientists. Still with us is Sarah Krepps, a professor of government at Cornell University and the director of the Tech Policy Institute. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks, Amy.
So in your piece for Foreign Affairs about American research, you say that during World War II, you say it was determined that scientific research was important to the prosperity and security of the United States. And a report was issued back then called Science, the Endless Frontier. And that kind of jump-started this whole idea that the government could see gain and they could gain something from funding research. So back then, what gains did we see immediately from this infusion of more money in the 1940s?
I mean, the big one, of course, was the Manhattan Project. And I'm actually writing a book that's coming out on innovation and kind of how society responds and then how innovations respond to those responses, kind of that dialectic. And it starts with the Manhattan Project, where these scientists who had been working on atomic fission, or, you know, atomic science for decades now, suddenly in the, you know, as the war hits, pivot to converting that scientific inquiry, which had started in just kind of an iterative, derivative way over a course of decades, now to scale that up. They needed huge injections of funding that at that time really only the federal government could do, and so that was that that injection of funding then led to that Manhattan Project that leads the United States to develop the first bomb, and then at the end of the war, Vannevar Bush, who had headed the Office of Scientific Research and Development, laid that intellectual foundation for a post-war U.S. science policy where basic research, he said, was essential to national security and economic growth, and that federal funding should support the long-term high-risk scientific inquiry. And so this decentralized model is what formed from that. And like you said, it expanded in the Cold War with the launch of Sputnik and led to what we see today.
Yeah, let's talk a little more recent of what we see today. So it is research that happened at universities that eventually led to the internet, right? I mean, they were trying something else, and they eventually, like, the reason we have the internet today is because of federal funding at universities.
It really is fascinating. I teach this in several of my law classes, how the internet had started with ARPANET, and they're just trying to connect these different nodes of communication. And then they realize kind of the efficiency and immediacy of this form of communication. Then it scales a little bit, just kind of like what we see with innovation more generally. You scale a little bit more, and then this thing takes off. And so no one, it wasn't as if, you know, this is like Silicon Valley TV show. We have this idea that we're going to incubate and turn into something. It really is that illustration, that case study of where the federal government was funding these projects. They start needing to communicate. They come up with this idea. And now, decades later, you have the internet.
Mm-hmm. Now, and also, even more recent times, now we're seeing the same thing with artificial intelligence, where, you know, and we can argue about whether America is leading the way in artificial intelligence. You know, that keeps going back and forth. But mm-hmm. the basis of what we know as AI today came in the same way, right?
Right. So the machine learning and that was taking place in universities. I think AI is also a little bit different now because there is, and I think this is not an unusual experience where at some point, if something becomes clearly commercializable, the bulk of the funding kind of pivots from federal to industry. And that's what we see now with AI, which is that the amount of money that these private firms, OpenAI, Microsoft, Anthropic, are dumping into AI now far dwarfs what the federal government is putting in, and certainly universities. But for a long time, again, that those kernels, that basic research that was seeded in universities, was at the hands of the federal government.
From a national security standpoint, what has America's research done to protect America? Because, you know, immediately you think of something like the Manhattan Project and being able to put an end to World War II. But what's something more recently that the federal government has funded that really is helping America stay secure?
I mean, I think there are a lot of examples of this. The one that I'm in some ways most familiar with is something called MIT Lincoln Labs. So I was in the Air Force in the late 90s and early 2000s, and I was based in the Boston area. And so MIT Lincoln Labs started during the Cold War as a microwave and radar research lab, and then kind of spun off after the Second World War. And they continue. It's just an interesting partnership because it has federal funding, it's connected to the university, and it continues to do national security research, some of which is classified, but in the service of the national defense. And so its history is grounded in that history, but it has that triangulation, if you will, of MIT and national security and federal funding in ways that I think, coming back to our earlier conversation, are part of that rich tapestry of where you're not going to get, it's almost like there's this kind of teamwork element of the whole being greater than the sum of its parts, because now you have some military people there and you have civilians and you have federal funding, and they all kind of come together to cross-pollinate and generate new ideas. And so I think that kind of example is what the U.S. does really has done well and has continued to do very well in terms of fueling national security projects.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the potential of America's brain drain due to recent federal funding cuts. Will America lose scientists to other countries? With us is Sarah Krepps, a professor of government at Cornell University and the director of the Tech Policy Institute. Now, we spoke earlier in the hour about the idea of how universities, in order to secure their funding or get some of their funding back, the Trump administration is asking them to follow along with some policies related to immigration, diversity, equity, and inclusion, that kind of thing. Do you see if universities basically agree to some of these things and get some of the money back, do you see things improving, or do you think that universities should try to continue on? Yeah, what's your take on that?
On that uncontroversial question.
Yeah, very fun.
Yeah, so I think it's been certainly a challenge for universities because these challenges to funding have come in fits and surges. And so I was, as I mentioned, part of a DOD project that had a stop work order. And this particular set of stop work orders for DOD was directed at Northwestern and Cornell. Others who have NSFs at Princeton were part of, and or even DOD were part of more of a DOGE level kind of cutting particular types of research. And so there are many different flavors of these things, which I think has made it a challenge for universities to respond, because it's not a one size fits all. If you do these things, then we'll now kind of unfreeze these grants. And I think Harvard, you know, they seem to be have the real bullseye on their backs and have stated categorically that they are just not, they've had seemingly more of a dialogue between themselves and the administration to kind of know what the administration was asking of them. In our particular case, and I think for many other universities, it's not entirely clear how to get out of the doghouse. And I think that's one of the sources of frustration, that it hasn't been made clear to us, for example, in my particular purge at Cornell, what the infraction was and therefore how to sort of, you know, exonerate ourselves. So I guess the short answer is we don't know. And I think the challenge as well is that, you know, how to navigate that uncertainty. And I think within universities, there really is a debate because there are a lot of scientists who are relying on this funding, and I think probably have more incentives to do what it has to, whatever needs to be done to get out from under that pressure. And I think there are other parts of the campuses that are kind of more stand your ground. We don't care at what expense. And I think for university leadership, they're having to thread that needle. And it's a real challenge, kind of figure out how to make these different constituencies and stakeholders happy, how to get the federal funding back with and mediate kind of these debates within their own faculty and alums and students. It's a real challenge.
You also wrote in your piece that Elon Musk created this university to SpaceX pipeline. He would reach out to aerospace departments at the top colleges around the country and ask about recruiting the best students that they have. So even though Elon Musk is in charge of some of these issues where we're pulling back federal money, he also does, I mean, he has to see the value in these institutions if he was recruiting them to work for SpaceX. What do you make of that?
Yeah, that one strikes me as puzzling because he's clearly benefited from and really exploited that university to SpaceX pipeline. And so he has not been a he would not have been able to do the work that he's done without access to universities. And if you think about it, universities are basically a free apprentice program for industry, whether it's NVIDIA or SpaceX or any of these tech firms, Google, OpenAI, they're all, it's really unusual to get a job at those places without a college degree. And so who's doing that educating and how are they doing it? They're doing it at universities that have federal funding that give people the experience. So I work with a mechanical engineer who has lost five DoD grants. He was training 5 to 10 PhD students, postdocs, undergrads. So that is just, again, a microcosm of where that pipeline now is leaking. So, and I think, you know, this is a longer story and probably its own show or a few, but, you know, the fact that Elon Musk is leaving the administration, I think probably speaks to the fact that some of these fissures in vision and ideology started to emerge. You know, I don't think he's a fan of tariffs. And so, you know, and his whole business model requires or hinges on not just the pipeline, but low tariffs. And that's not necessarily what we've seen in some of these policies.
And we talked earlier about private money stepping up and whether there is private money out there to help with some of these research projects. But there's also private firms. There's the idea that a private firm could lure away a scientist from a university, because private firms do their own research. Is there anything wrong with leaving a university setting and going to work for a private company?
It's also a really good point. And there have been a number of articles in the New York Times and Boston Globe about MIT and Harvard faculty leaving to go work in industry because Boston is a real biotech hub. And so, you know, the pay is better. I think we've recruited people at Cornell from industry. And I always say, oh, that just seems like you have the best of all worlds. You can do your research and you get paid more and you don't have, you know, you don't have these other trappings of the university that, you know, have their pros and cons. And people always say, yes, but you can't do the research you want to do. So if you work at Microsoft, you do the work that they're telling you to do because you don't have that academic freedom because Microsoft is trying to make money. And they have decided what the vehicle or avenue is to make that money. And so they say that they come to the university because that is a two-way street because we do get people from industry who say they just want to work on the projects they think are interesting and important, not be told what they are supposed to be working on. And so I think it's again kind of coming back to what we've talked about earlier is that the grass is not necessarily greener. It can be just a different set of problems.
Well, we have less than a minute left, and I wanted to kind of end on how we continue to recruit people. You know, if someone going through a PhD program right now, what would you say to them in just like 30 seconds to get them to stay?
It's a hard question because I think it requires a little bit of the long game. I tend to be an optimist, and I've been around now a while, that I think we've gone and we have ups and downs, but I do think that the university, U.S. university system is resilient and will come out of this maybe even stronger.
Well, thank you to Sarah Kreps, a professor in the Department of Government at Cornell and the director of the Tech Policy Institute. Professor Kreps, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Amy.
And this has been All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and I'm Amy Jurevich. I want to say thank you to our senior producer, Marcus Charleston, producer Aaron Esmont-Rabinowitz, and our student producers, Chris Corcoran, David Stein, Iza Huck, and Colin Simpson. Special thank you to Colin Simpson for producing this show today. Video production is by The Ohio Channel. Board operation is by Chris Johnston and Cameron Howard. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.